Hi, everybody. I'm Bob McGregor. Welcome to Head to Head, the sports show that gets inside the stories to understand the big picture. Today, we'll examine the practices of high school football. Two deaths last week have raised new concerns for our kids. Are we really doing enough to keep the players safe? Plus, everywhere you turn, there's another story about Alex Rodriguez. What drives athletes to cheat? Who's more likely to succumb to the temptations? And are the fans partly to blame? We'll talk to a couple of experts on morality and ethics and get the perspective of two former NFL players. And later, can an athlete try too hard? When you're at the top of your game, even the most difficult achievement seems effortless. But when success starts to wane, is it possible to psych yourself out? Tiger Woods is still trying to regain his former self. We'll see what a sports psychologist has to say about it. It's all ahead this afternoon on Head to Head.
Broncos linebacker Von Miller received a six-game suspension under the NFL's substance abuse policy. It will cost him more than $800,000 of his nearly $2.3 million he's scheduled to make this season. Sticking with PEDs, a lawyer for Alex Rodriguez has declined Major League Baseball's challenge to make public evidence that led to his 211-game suspension. Rodriguez is playing pending his appeal, which likely won't be decided by an arbitrator until at least November. I'm Stephen Bowers. That's your sports update brought to you by Pru Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
Welcome back. This is Head to Head. I'm Bob McGregor. A Georgia high school football player dies after suffering a devastating neck injury in a preseason scrimmage Friday night. DeAndre Turman, a junior cornerback at Creekside High School in Fairburn, Georgia, suffered a broken neck. This follows on the heels of the death of 14-year-old Mitchell Cook. He died a week ago, several hours after collapsing following warm-ups for freshman football practice at Canyon High School in Anaheim. Now, surprisingly, the Sports Legacy Institute of Boston University notes that in high school football, 60 to 75% of all head trauma is suffered in practice. In the NFL, that number is virtually zero. Something parents are concerned about, coaches are concerned about. How do we protect our kids? Joining me right now, Terry O'Neill. He's the former New Orleans Saints senior vice president and founder of Practice Like Pros. Terry, your son is somebody who's in high school football?
He's just graduated in May, Bob, yep. And he's one of the lucky ones. He actually leaves Monday for Tufts University in Boston, where he's nice. One of the three recruited quarterbacks in the freshman class. So in spite of his many injuries in high school, he survived to play college football, and he couldn't be more excited about it.
Well, congratulations to him. Liam is his name, correct?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is what perplexes me. In this day and age, we know more about the human body. We know more about what makes our body work and what makes it break. We know more about hyperthermia, about dehydration, about concussions. And yet, we're still seeing these instances where kids are dying on a football field. Shouldn't happen.
No, that's right. And all those advances you talk about have not been matched by any change, really, in the way high school football practice is being conducted today. It's about the same as it was 40, 50, 70 years ago. Whereas in the NFL, under pressure from the players in the last collective bargaining agreement, there was a vast change in which the players have insisted on dramatically less contact. No off-season full contact whatever, only one practice per week in season, and in this preseason, which you're experiencing right now, only one full contact practice per day. If there's a second practice, it must be non-contact. And those new standards have to filter down through college football to high school football, and what we're doing at Practice Like Pros is advocating a modified standard of the NFL practice regimen on the high school fields.
Okay, forget for a minute about, you know, the risks of litigation. Wouldn't the schools want to be doing the same sort of thing if it means a safer environment for the players?
If they were fully educated, our belief is that they will make these changes. But Bob, there is, you'll find if you jump into it as we have, an enormous lack of education among school boards, headmasters, head coaches, athletic directors, the state associations, the governing bodies that run and make rules for high school football in each of the 50 states. What they don't know about this is alarming, and yet we find their willingness to learn is very encouraging. In the first clinic that we staged a week ago in Worcester, Massachusetts, there was a tremendous thirst to see on video how the pros practice and understand how that can easily translate to high school football.
The coaches themselves at the high school level, do they have access to that kind of training through the school system, or are they leaning more on, you know, how they were coached when they were in high school?
Yeah, exactly. They are largely unsupervised. What's happened really in these athletic programs is that there is such an enormous number of sports. Funding is limited. Staffing is limited. The athletic director is normally trying to keep pace with as many as 25 or 30 athletic programs simultaneously within his jurisdiction. And so he often leaves the head football coach to do exactly as he chooses without much supervision. And that head coach is normally a captive of what he learned as a player 20 years earlier. And it's the reason why a group like ours has to come to him with sincerity and with information in hand and show him. Through the great college coaches and the great pro coaches who have joined us in this movement, show him on video and speak to him in a clinic and demonstrate to him how his practices can be so much safer and yet keep all the skill level and the effectiveness, the efficiency, the preparation for Friday night, keep all that in place and yet have a healthy roster, a healthy full roster ready to play those games on Friday nights.
Okay. When we come back after the break, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about how the coaches are accepting that sort of thing. So stay with us. We'll be right back on Head to Head. Welcome back to Head to Head. I'm Bob McGregor, your host, and I'm speaking with Terry O'Neill. He's the former New Orleans Saints senior vice president and founder of Practice Like Pros. We are talking about making it safer for high school students playing football to ensure that they're doing it safely. And Terry, you said that you've already launched Practice Like Pros. What was the reaction to the coaches that you talked to last week?
You know, before our first clinic in Worcester, Massachusetts, the head of the Massachusetts Coaches Association, which represents about 300 football-playing schools in the state, said to me, "Terry, we would all like to practice with less contact. We just don't know how." And so at the clinic, we brought in person, we brought the head coach of Dartmouth, Buddy Tevens, who came with 15 or 20 minutes of his practice drills on videotape. We brought the Dr. Robert Cantu, who is the number one concussion expert in the country, a co-founder of the Sports Legacy Institute at Boston University in 2007. And then on videotape, we brought David Shaw, the Stanford coach. We brought video from the Cleveland Browns. We brought Mike Ditka and Chris Berman of ESPN, all of them advocating our position. And so whatever resistance there might have been in the audience when we started had melted 2 hours later. And as the coaches walked out unanimously, they gave the program thumbs up and said, "Look, please send us copies of these videos so we can implement them immediately. Our practice begins this week. We want to start practicing like the pros right away." And if we get a chance with a sponsor to take this message around the country in the next off season, I predict for you, Bob, we are going to revolutionize high school football and bring these injury statistics dramatically down.
So what's next for Practice Like Pros? Is this something you want to carry through on a tour of the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm in conversation with four top global brands, asking them which one of them wants to become the brand that revolutionizes high school football. I'm farther down the road with one than the others. I'm having very optimistic conversations with one of them. And the idea is to take this clinic, which we videotaped in Massachusetts and have edited into a 27-minute video summary that we're showing to our supporters and these potential sponsors, and they're loving it, I'm glad to say. We're going to take this clinic with video, with instruction, with hand delivery of a new practice regimen for high school football around the country, make 40 or 50 stops in the coming off season. And within a couple of years, we will have changed the culture, and you'll find these high school boys practicing the way they practice in the NFL.
Nice. How do we find out more about Practice Like Pros?
www.practicelikepros.com.
Awesome. Thanks, Terry. Wish you all the best.
Great, Bob. Thanks for your interest.
Thank you. Terry O'Neill, former New Orleans Saints senior vice president, founder of Practice Like Pros. After the break, we talk steroids. Stay with us. Welcome back to Head to Head. I'm Bob McGregor, your host, and steroids in the news everywhere you turn. Alex Rodriguez, do we really need to say any more? He continues to play while he appeals his suspension for alleged use of performance-enhancing substances. Latest news, we've got the Denver linebacker, Von Miller, out for 6 games for not using a substance he wasn't supposed to, but for abusing the policy, which says that you need to submit to testing when you're asked. So he's going to lose about $800,000 in income on that one. For those of you who even know what curling is about, the Canadian men's curler, Matt Dumontel, he's a spare for the World Men's Championship, suspended 2 years for an anti-doping rule violation. And this one wasn't even the back alley type doping. This was using supplements that apparently weren't authorized. New allegations that Yankees GM Brian Cashman may have misled investigators regarding PEDs and Roger Clemens. I could go on and on. Right now, I've got Dr. Adam Naylor. He's a sports psychologist at Boston University, and he's the author of an article on baseball PEDs and the moral ambiguities with it. And Dr. Hiram LeTourneur, professor of humanities and ethics at Prairie State College, just outside of Chicago. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Start with you, Dr. Naylor. Can you help me to understand what the problem is that we're still talking about performance-enhancing drugs years and years after these things first started boiling up and we first started hearing about it?
Yeah, you know, I really think we always think about it as an individual problem, but it's really a social psychology problem when you think about the end of it. It's something that, to baseball players, football players, seems like a victimless crime, and we know there's ethical dilemmas. If you don't see the victim or feel the victim, you can make some ethical missteps. And then just the social factor that at the pro sports level, it's accepted, whether it be tacitly or overtly. You know, you mentioned the new news about Cashman, and you know, we talk a very good game about our pros, but we're quite accepting of these things.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, when you hear the athletes talk about it, they all seem to be against it. And yet, it's not just one or two guys. It's a lot of people. So whether they're, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we're not in favor of this, or whether they're really just not aware of how rampant it is, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it seems, you know, we all have our blind sides. It seems tough to be unaware of it, but I recall over a decade ago being down at spring training and thinking the Texas Rangers looked enormous. Man, they must work out a lot, and I should know better than that. So we all have these blind sides, and that includes the players. And I think there's also, as you mentioned, you know, on the Canadian curler one, there's so many substances out there, it's almost tough to navigate. So I think there's also an ignorance at some level on top of it all.
Dr. LeTourneur, when it comes to the ethical side of whether or not we use this or not, I mean, the argument has been put forward to fans. Would you rather have guys who don't cheat, or would you rather have a team full of cheaters so that the playing field is level? Does that say something about where we're at in our acceptance of this right now?
Boy, yeah, that's tough. I think that there are some people who are advocating the legalization of performance-enhancing drugs in sports, you know, for just an open and level playing field. And I suppose on one hand, we think of sport as simply a business of entertainment, in which case it's entertaining to see guys who, you know, are unnaturally large or unnaturally able to do feats of great strength or endurance as a result of performance-enhancing drugs, and it makes the sport, you know, that much more entertaining. Trying to level the playing field, there are lots of efforts, arguments to try to justify an altered stance on performance-enhancing drugs in sports. Does that answer your question, Tom?
It does. So when it comes to the individual teams and the front office management, I mean, their job is to win a pennant or to win a cup or to win a title. And really, they're not handing the drugs to these players. So is there a sort of a look the other way kind of thing that might be going on here?
I wouldn't be surprised. It's hard to know, you know, how much responsibility do the team's management feel for the decisions made by, you know, individual teams. Though there is a history of performance-enhancing drugs being used in a systematic way among teams, you know, all the way back through the Olympics. And even in sports that aren't as big in the United States, like cycling, where entire groups or teams of players will complicitly win a third team event and won medals, and then later sued their respective governments for the systematic use of performance-enhancing drugs. So there is some instances where it seems that team management is involved, and not just turning a blind eye, but, you know, actively helping players dope. And then I think probably more prevalently, there are athletes who feel the need to use drugs to enhance their performance, and teams don't actively prevent them.
Right. Well, Dr. Naylor, you wrote an article earlier this month in The Sporting Life talking about baseball and PEDs, and you get into the question of moral ambiguity. And part of it is, as you said, the fabric of elite sports, and part of it is that the fan base is kind of also turning a blind eye to the fact that, as you say, their physique sometimes look more like that of a comic book superhero than an average human being.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. You know, there is obviously, you know, there's a long history of this in sport, trying to get ahead and get an edge. I do think there's a moral certainty about cheating, but it seems like as a, you know, societally and individually within the sports, there's that, you know, we often have heard the saying, it's only cheating if you get caught. And, you know, I think it's said tongue-in-cheek sometimes, but there's truth to that when that comes out loud. Yeah.
When we ask, and ESPN actually did a thing earlier in this year in May where they asked a bunch of athletes what they considered to be, you know, sort of the big cheating scandal or the big wrongdoing. And although performance-enhancing drugs did weigh into it, they thought it was a bigger deal when, say, a referee's betting on a game. So the players, on one hand, seem to be against it, but on the other hand, they don't necessarily see it as the worst thing that could happen for an athlete.
Absolutely. I think it's a little further down the list than perhaps it should be, because if we think just grand scheme of things, and this is where we really lose our vision when looking at pro sports, it's unhealthy. And at the end of the day, in theory, sports is about health and wellness, but when you get to those highest levels, we tend to forget that. We know Olympic athletes and professional athletes are pretty damaged at the end of their careers, and it's something that they accept quite readily. And I'd argue probably this is something that they add into the pile of an accepted damage they're going to do to live out their dream and do fairly well for a while.
Dr. LaTurner, would it be fair for us to consider making performance-enhancing drugs just a part of the game? Like, I mean, almost giving up. If you can't beat them, join them?
I think there would be some real ethical problems with that sort of decision. If you think about performance-enhancing drugs, minimally there are several different reasons why I think it's wise and in the best interest of the long term of sport to try to fight the battle, even if, you know, there's going to be difficulties in winning. First, the health of the athletes. Certainly, performance-enhancing drugs promise great benefits, but they come at a great cost to the long term health of the athletes who engage in them. And second, there's some notion of the spirit of sport that I think we would lose if you sort of succumb to this no holds barred kind of thinking that if we can't stop good sportsmanship or bad sportsmanship from happening, if we can't prevent people from cheating, then let's just let them let's change the rules so that cheating isn't happening anymore. I think that's a bit simplistic and perhaps unfair to sport as a general way of life. The idea of sportsmanship and of fair play is part of what makes achievements in athletic events so wonderful and so awe-inspiring. And if you give that over to drugs and performance-enhancing substances, I think we would lose something that's deeply important about playing games.
Yeah, good points from both of you. I know this is a subject that we will still be talking about a year from now and probably 5-10 years from now. But I thank you both for your input on this, and I hope that in the future we can have you both on the show and talk more about it.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Great to be here.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll have more from the player's perspective coming up in just a few minutes, but first, sports headlines.
I'm Stephen Bowers with your sports update brought to you by Prue Sports Management. Boston's Ryan Dempster was suspended for 5 games and fined by Major League Baseball for intentionally hitting Yankees star Alex Rodriguez with a pitch last weekend at Fenway Park. Yankees manager Joe Girardi was fined for arguing with plate umpire Brian O'Nora. Dempster's fine was $2,500 and Girardi's $5,000. Dempster said it was in the best interest of the team to go ahead and serve the suspension, although he maintained that he was only pitching inside and not trying to hit Alex Rodriguez. I'm Stephen Bowers, and that's your sports update brought to you by Prue Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
We are back, Bob McGregor on Head to Head, and this is the BBS Radio Network. I am speaking now with a couple of former NFL players, former linebackers, who actually spent some time on the same team together, as well as other teams in the NFL, talking about performance-enhancing drugs and getting a player perspective on it. And so today I've asked John Holosik and Gerald Dixon to join me to have a brief conversation on performance-enhancing drugs, where they see it back when they were playing, if they saw it, and how they think about it today. Both are now involved in other things, but still involved with football. Is that correct, guys?
Yes, I'm a high school football coach.
Okay, that's John Holosik. And Gerald, you're also involved both in teaching and coaching, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And Gerald, you've got a couple of sons who are playing football right now, too.
Yeah, I have 2 sons at the University of South Carolina.
Okay.
One's a defensive end, and one is a defensive tackle.
Nice.
And they both named a Gerald.
No way.
You couldn't do that, could you, John?
No, I certainly couldn't do that.
So tell me, guys, yeah. When you both played around the same time through the mid to late 90s and into the 2000s, did you find that any kind of use of either growth hormones or performance-enhancing drugs was open and something that you saw in the locker room, or was it something that people just kind of talked about, or was it more of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink kind of thing?
Well, for me, I came in 95, and we walked into the Buffalo Bills where six Hall of Famers are playing, and they certainly didn't look like they were taking performance-enhancing drugs. It wasn't a huge deal, I thought, then up until 2000. I didn't even know it was around. In 2002, my last year, I heard some rumors of some people, you know, just blew up. But it was post the Demerol, the stuff that you could test through your urine, and so it wasn't relevant, we thought. I thought when I was playing until the very, very end of my career, and that's when you heard whispers, but you certainly didn't see it in the locker room on any occasion.
Gerald?
And I came in 92 and with the Cleveland Browns, and those guys, Kevin Magnone there and Hanford Dixon, all those guys that was there, and there was nothing that I could detect that anything like that was around those guys, or in Michael Dean, Perry, he was there also, and those guys didn't seem like they was taking anything, and from my perspective, I never seen it in the locker room or ever heard about it in the locker room the way it's going now. I mean, it's totally different thing now.
I thought our drug test, our random drug test, the urine test, would catch the normal steroids that were around in the 80s that the NFL really abolished by the random drug testing. Stuff that you can hide, that you can only test with through your blood, was not around until the early 2000s.
So really what was happening at that time is that guys were already starting to think about beating the system and getting around whatever testing was available at that time. Whether or not that ended up, you know, including some of your teammates, probably not, but it would have been something that – sorry, go ahead.
In my experience, it was the guys that were struggling to get in the NFL that would risk cheating. It wasn't the natural good athletes that were already there and from in the late 90s. You know, you had some guys that – maybe come from a junior college that could have done steroids, but all Division I schools were tested for it, and the performance enhanced the non-testable drugs didn't really come out until basically the Sammy Sosa's of the world, you know, in the late 90s and then early 2000s, and it's still you'd have to go find it, you'd have to spend a lot of money, you know, trying to cover all your tracks, and it didn't seem like the normal good NFL football player needed it.
And I agree with that too. I agree with what totally John saying on that. I just didn't see it that the natural guys that was playing starters, that, you know, the guys that looked like, you know, they were just barely trying to hang on. That might have been your guy that might have been trying to do that, but the guys that were out there beat. That was out there every week. It was totally different.
So the guys that are on the practice roster, the guys who were brought in and given a shot, given a look, did you get a sense that any of them might have been?
Well, there's certain people that get caught in college, and they get, I don't think they get banned or suspended yet because they're not in the NFL, but you know of these people. There's several people that I played with that got caught and were suspended or you know, tested a lot because they had a history there, and they caught them at the combine or whatnot. There's certain people like that. But as far as, like, the new drugs are concerned, the ones that are happening now, I just don't know where you'd find a trustworthy doctor. Why would you want to, you know, risk your reputation to cover, you know, and all that cover-up? I mean, baseball, you see these guys, it seems like it's common because – just a long season, and it just more prevalent. Football, you know, you have 16 games. Your body's important, but we do have, you know, enough time to build yourself up and correct things without you're not making huge strides, and you're not playing every single day. So it just doesn't seem like Big Gerald Dixon is 265 pounds and he can run like a deer. Why would he need it? You know. So there's certain people that might need it, but I still don't know if the practice squad people, those kids trying to make it, have the incentive to or the risk.
Yeah. Okay. I have a couple more questions for you. I'm just going to take a short break, and we'll be back with John Holosik and Gerald Dixon. Back to Head to Head. I'm Bob McGregor, and I'm speaking with John Holosik and Gerald Dixon, former NFL linebackers who are now in coaching mode, and talking today about performance-enhancing drugs and the other steroids and hormones and all the other stuff that we're hearing so much about now in professional sports. Seems to be more prevalent these days, at least in the headlines for Major League Baseball, but we also are hearing more and more about NFL players and about teams taking on the performance-enhancing drugs and trying to get a better handle on it. From your perspective, and I'll open this up to either John or Gerald, doesn't matter, but is it more acceptable today that guys may be cheating using this stuff as opposed to 10 years ago?
From my perspective, I don't think it's acceptable anywhere in the NFL or any major league or any sport that, like John himself, he's a linebacker that established himself in Buffalo and, you know, stuck the middle up and, you know, by him going in the weight room and every day and doing the work that he had to do to build up his self to be able to stand that for the years that he played, that's cheating him by him working hard and, you know, telling these younger kids to go out and, you know, work hard and, you know, get your education. And you might as well tell them to go ahead and, you know, cheat on your tests and cheat through life to get through. And that's what I think this drug does to athletes. It teaches them how to cheat, how to steal, and other things, you know.
And no athlete that's not taking it is going to accept it because you're taking money off their table. You're going to get paid less if you're not cheating. If that's the case, then, you know, everyone that's not taking steroids or performance-enhancing drugs should be just adamant against it, which that's why I think the majority of the NFL is going to go along with the testing. It should be done. It should be, you know, it's very taboo in the locker room because no one's going to admit to it because you're cheating your fellow player because you're going to perform better because you're cheating. So nobody wants it.
No. No, definitely didn't.
And at the high school level and at the college level, is this something that is being openly talked about with players? Is this something that, you know, there's a dialogue already there and the kids are not necessarily told, but...
I think the problem nowadays is not just it's the GNC, the federal regulation that does not look at any of the supplements, over-the-counter stuff that you can buy at any, you know, local store. That's the real problem. I don't think anyone's going to go out and be talking to Balco and paying $50,000 in high school. But the over-the-counter stuff that's not regulated, that's the stuff you have to worry about.
Yeah.
Yes.
And do you find that kids are coming to you to ask you what your thought is on this stuff? Have they
yeah.
talked to you about growth hormones?
I think anyone that's going to work with kids in a weight room or in a football environment is going to have kids that want to get better, and they might push the limits. So you better be inform them of the risk and mm-hmm. just the knowledge is power when it comes to this, where if you have a good, nutritious diet, you can do almost as much or you know, limit so many risks that you could take on by doing stupid things or unknown things. So it's definitely going to be an informative thing. And I always tell the kids, diet is 95% of everything. When you're trying to put on weight and lifting weights, you have to eat right. And so that, I think, is pushed more nowadays than ever.
In my school, we have a trainer that tells them every day that they got to get their nutrition in their body and do the right things. And we also have a weightlifting coach that, you know, makes sure to push them to the limit where they can perform on the football field. But, you know, it's kids that want to do better. But, you know, that's come with extra work and being dedicated to your work ethic.
Yeah. Okay, I have one more question for you guys. We're going to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, I'm going to switch stories a little bit and talk about a story that happened late last week with a high school football player that got injured during a practice. We'll talk about that when we come back from break. Back with Head to Head, I'm Bob McGregor, and we're talking with John Holosik and Gerald Dixon, former NFL linebackers, now in coaching, and they are working with the futures of the NFL, and as well, you know, a story we talked about a little bit earlier on in the hour, death on the gridiron, a Georgia high school student died after a devastating neck injury in a preseason game last Friday night. Raises questions about how safe football is at the high school and college levels, and Whether or not parents ought to be more concerned or whether or not coaches should be taking more precautions, that sort of thing. I wanted to get your perspective on it, guys. As coaches, do you emphasize to these guys the fragility of the human body and the things that they need to do in terms of neck exercises and all that sort of stuff to ensure that they can play the game safely?
Well, I think that technique in high school is the biggest thing that you have to teach a kid, because that kid is 18, 17. He's watching NFL in college play at that time. He wants to perform just like that NFL guy. But as we know, in the NFL, they are some of the terrible tacklers in the world because they don't wrap up. But in high school, you have to teach the kids the basis of wrapping up, form tackling, keeping your head up, and all of that, bowing your neck and things like that. And I think NFL, they're taking their head out of the game now. And because of guys that have taken so many shots on guys like that and throwing their body out at guys and knocking them out. And that's the thing that's the difference in high school, that you have to make sure they perform as a high school and have the proper techniques to not say it's going to take away from a guy being injured like that, but it will help prevent things like that happening.
Yeah.
If I was going to push my kids into football, I would just make sure that the coach is teaching those techniques and providing a safe environment. If you know your coach, which I'd expect every parent to get to know the program and the coach and watch practice and make sure they're doing safe things, then I have no problem with it. I have a fifth grader that's going to start this year, I have no qualms about it because I do know the program. It is obviously risky when you don't know the coach and he's doing drills that have been discontinued, but that is so rare these days. And unfortunately, freak accidents can happen in any type of physical activity. So I didn't see it. I'm not informed on it. But, yeah, the technique that you teach is paramount.
Okay. And are we at fault to some degree? And when I say we, I guess I'm talking about the media and also the fan base that really focuses in on those big hits and the highlight reel type stuff that Gerald was talking about a little bit earlier. You know, those plays that aren't necessarily good tackles, but they sure look great on video.
Yeah, you're not going to have a form tackle that's done correctly and doesn't look violent on the lead in for Madden football. So
yeah,
it's absolutely part of our culture. Look at the normal movie and how many acts of violence. Violence is here and it attracts eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
And are you guys, like, in your own personal practices, are you doing contact during practice, or is it pretty limited?
These days, it's much, much more limited than the past. And personally speaking, we got away from it when one of my former players, son of Matt Suey, the longtime Chicago Bear, twisted his ankle in a drill that we didn't need to be doing, and I missed. You know, he was going to miss the first couple games, and I was the best player on my team. So,
no.
Why lose a guy in practice when you could do full speed non-contact stuff? So we try to limit it, but we have to do a little just because people need the practice of tackling and need some live stuff, but it's much more limited these days.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for joining me and bringing me your insight and getting a little bit behind the scenes of what it's like to be a pro athlete.
No problem. Yes, thank you.
That's part of the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Gerald.
I'm Stephen Bowers with your sports update, brought to you by Prue Sports Management. In a businessman special at Citi Field in New York, the Atlanta Braves defeated the New York Mets 4-1 in 10 innings to split a two-game series. Chris Johnson hit a three-run homer for Atlanta in the 10th to provide the winning margin. The Braves' Jason Hayward was hit in the face with a pitch in the 6th inning and had to leave the game. He was being evaluated at a Manhattan hospital. I'm Stephen Bowers, and that's your sports update brought to you by Pru Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
Welcome back. This is Head to Head. I'm Bob McGregor, your host, and we're talking about dry spells. Tiger Woods has now gone 5 years without winning a major. Is he trying too hard to regain his form? Can an athlete, pro or amateur, psych themselves out, becoming their own worst enemy? We're going to talk to a sports psychologist to understand what happens when successful athletes hit the wall. Joining me is Dr. Jeffrey Pauline, sports psychologist and professor at Syracuse University, a private consultant, and a former assistant tennis coach. Dr. Pauline, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So can you psych yourself out? Can you just try too hard to be that good?
In a sense, no. I think what a lot of athletes, especially at the elite level, talking like somebody like Tiger Woods, the aspect of trying too hard is kind of just innate. It's kind of what they actually do. They tend to over-prepare. They tend to get themselves in the best kind of physical position they can to kind of perform their best. But in terms of on the mental side, you mentioned the idea of kind of psyching themselves out. And really, that leads to most athletes really not being kind of present-centered focused, focusing
right.
on outcome, things that they actually can't control. And that is what we see quite often in terms of maybe sometimes the downfall of not just elite athletes, but lesser qualified athletes do as well.
So is it a confidence thing, or is it that you're too busy thinking about each of your moves and not really letting your body do the work?
Yeah, to do its thing. Sure. I wish I had an exact potion or formula to say that, you know, 50% confidence, 20% self-awareness. It doesn't kind of work exactly that way because it's so different for each and every person. For some people, it could be a little bit lacking in confidence. In other people, it could be a little bit lack of kind of self-awareness. And other people, it could be, not present-centered focus. So it's usually a combination of kind of a variety of things. And it's usually not just one. It's a combination of those things. And sometimes it just takes athletes to take some time and continue to work on the physical things, but also take some time to work kind of on their mental game as well. So it could be that aspect of kind of working a little bit more on the mental side of things.
So when an athlete comes to you and says, look, I used to be really good at this, and now I'm really having trouble getting back to that level of performance.
Right.
Where do you start?
Well, there's a lot of factors. Usually what I try and do is kind of let them lead, you know, ask them kind of, what have they tried? What have you done? And like a lot of people, they'll keep doing the same thing over and over and always expecting the same kind of returns. And usually that's what you get. But there might be diminishing skills, there might be less time towards practice, there could be increased distraction. So there could be, a variety of factors kind of playing in there. But I always like to find out, what have you tried? Have you tried something new, whether it's equipment-related or technique-related? And then also, what have you done perhaps in terms of preparation on the mental side? So I like to kind of find out what they've done and, where they are in terms of that kind of stance.
Is it different for an individual athlete versus one who's playing on a team?
Definitely. Everybody is usually, like I said, especially elite-level sports, everybody's usually kind of committed. That's kind of not the issue, but everybody has their own individual nuances, strengths, and kind of weaknesses. So it tends to be somewhat a little bit more of a challenge maybe sometimes for a consultant working with a team compared to an individual sport athlete, because you're just kind of focused on one individual compared to, maybe like a lacrosse team that might have, 40, athletes on it. So,
yeah.
And everybody's got their own kind of strengths and weaknesses. So from a consultant's point, you've got to just be conscious of that and trying to kind of meet the individual needs of kind of the teammates. And from an individual kind of competition standpoint, I think, there's some strengths that individual sport athletes have. That's usually why they've been probably drawn to individual sports where, they're, it's kind of all on them. And they kind of quite often kind of enjoy that experience.
Well, as a coach psychologist only, I would think that it can sometimes be a bit of, I guess some people refer to it as poison, if somebody in the locker room in a team sport has a defeatist attitude and it starts to seep its way into the rest of the team.
Definitely, and that could be the cause of some slumps or some teams that actually kind of aren't, playing up to expectations. You hopefully think that all players on a team are going to be optimistic. And that can be some of the, barriers that might be involved with some teams kind of reaching that, expected level of kind of performance. That's not uncommon in locker rooms.
Well, and we've seen that too. The New York Rangers at one time brought in a whole bunch of top-notch players, and expected that they were going to win the Stanley Cup with it, and it didn't happen. They just didn't seem to have the right, I guess for want of a better word, the right chemistry. They didn't seem to be working as a unit. And, I can think back to some past New York Yankees teams as well where it on paper they sure looked like they had a championship team, but it just wasn't working out. Now, is that sort of that same line of thinking, the psychology of the team at work there?
There's definitely kind of a psychological or kind of the piece that goes along with kind of any kind of performance. And when you're bringing kind of new players into the mix, it's not just, meshing the skills, and you can put the best forwards you have and the best defensemen out there, but, how do they actually kind of work together too as well? And really, do they have the same kind of goals? Everybody says that they kind of want to win a championship, and that's important to them. But, how hard or how much are they really kind of willing to maybe sacrifice and work towards that? So you're always kind of trying to balance that out kind of in a team atmosphere too as well. So there's definitely a kind of component. And again, it relates to how much of the focus is maybe just directly on themselves compared to the, the buy-in of what the team's actually trying to do.
So when it comes to Tiger Woods, we all know that his dry spell came about the same time that some other personal things were happening in his life. Is there any kind of connection between those two that, legitimately could be hampering him from being back at regaining that form that he had?
Definitely. Research kind of shows there is a relationship in terms of kind of the distractions that are kind of going around one's life, whether on the course, off the course, and, the kind of performance. One of the things you've seen with Tiger Woods is, my thoughts and view is he's back. I feel that. Just watching him, I was fortunate to actually see him play at the PGA a couple of rounds, and he didn't perform up to what he did the week before. But he still seemed to kind of carry himself pretty much in a similar way. He just seemed like he had a belief in what he was doing. I watched him quite a bit on the range and what he was actually kind of going through in terms of his routines. He seemed much more kind of dialed in and focused on what he was doing. And clearly we all know he had a tremendous amount of distractions in his life, on the course, off the course. And for people to kind of put that to the side and go out and kind of do their job in a very public way, that he actually does this is tremendously difficult. Obviously, I don't know him personally, but it seemed like, you know, a lot of attention and effort was drawn towards, you know, getting that part of his life in order, and it seems like it's come together for him, and we're seeing him perform better on the course. Yes, he hasn't won a major in a few years now, but, you know, the week before, like I said, he just won the tournament the week before, and if you look at the strength of the field that he played against, it's pretty comparable to the PGA. The really difference was it had a different title to it. So he beat very similar competition the week before, but didn't do it kind of the next week. But my view is it's going to happen. It's going to come because he's just brought himself back to kind of a point, I think, of where he's focused. He's limited some of those distractions, and he's not probably so much concerned about outcome. He's really dialed in on his practice and getting better day in and day out and taking those challenges on.
He's centered.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
You can.
All right.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Pauline, sports psychologist, professor at Syracuse University. And if we have need for a sports psychologist, I'd love to give you a call down the road.
Great. Definitely. Look forward to it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Well, that's it for today's show. My thanks to our guest, Terry O'Neill, former New Orleans Saints senior vice president and founder of Practice Like Pros, Dr. Adam Naylor, sports psychologist, Dr. Hiram LeTurner, professor of humanities and ethics, John Holasek, former NFL linebacker from 95 to 2002 with the Buffalo Bills, San Diego Chargers, and Atlanta Falcons, Gerald Dixon, former NFL linebacker from 92 to 2001 with the Cleveland Browns, Cincinnati Bengals, San Diego Chargers, and the Oakland Raiders, and Dr. Jeffrey Pauline, sports psychologist and professor at Syracuse University. Thank you all for your contributions, and thank you for listening. This is Head to Head with your host, Bob McGregor, live from BBS Radio in Los Angeles. We're heard on the drive every weekday from 3 to 4 Pacific, 6 to 7 Eastern. BBSRadio.com is available on your smartphone, laptop, and iPad. We're back tomorrow. Have a great night.